The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
So, ever since 2016, I've been reading about Reconstruction. A little about the Civil War as well, and about abolitionists in the 1840s and 50s before the war. And what I want to know is, what happens when there's a political debate, which is a fight over the actual meaning of the United States, a fight about whether the meaning of this country is freedom and justice and life, or if the meaning of the country is hatred and death. If ordinary party politics transforms into a fight like this, what happens after that? In 1860, Lincoln was elected. He was a Republican, and they were the Progressive Party at the time. And Southern Democrats were afraid that Lincoln's election meant that slavery would end soon. And so they seceded. And the next year, war broke out, and almost a million Americans died. So that's one kind of outcome to polarization. And what happens after that? How do we ever return to democratic processes and ordinary life after something like that? After the war, the radical Republicans in Congress passed laws and constitutional amendments that forced Southern whites to respect the rights of freed Black people. At the peak, 15 congressmen and 2 Black senators were elected during Reconstruction, and Black people held about 15% of state and local offices. But white supremacy was only partly interrupted, and not for very long. White Northerners and the Republican Party kind of lost their appetite for enforcing Reconstruction after a while. And meanwhile, white Democrats in the South were staging coups and rebellions to overthrow the elected governments and to replace them with white supremacist governments, state by state. In 1876, the presidential election was a tie, and the Democrats and Republicans made a deal that the Republicans would maintain the presidency, but the last Union troops withdrew from the South, and white Democrats were allowed to, as they said, redeem the final state governments and replace them with white supremacist ones. They passed Jim Crow laws, and Blacks in the South were denied freedom and life for another century. But you can imagine what they would say if this all happened today. At least civility is restored. At least Democrats and Republicans can talk to each other as human beings. At least we're not so polarized anymore, so long as everybody is white. I just read a new biography of Frederick Douglass, titled Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight. And I wanted to understand how Douglass's passion for justice endured throughout his whole career, throughout the whole 19th century, despite defeat after defeat. He was born a slave in Maryland, probably in 1818. The property of a man named Thomas Auld. Auld's sister-in-law taught Frederick Douglass to read at the age of 12, and when Douglass was 19, he lived in Baltimore, and his labor was rented out. He worked as a ship calker on the docks. He met a woman 5 years older than he, named Anna Murray, a freed Black woman. They fell in love. and she scraped together enough money for a train ticket to New York. Douglas fled to freedom on the train. Anna Murray met him and in New York soon after, and they immediately married. Douglas later wrote, "I have often been asked how I felt when first I found myself on free soil. And my readers may share the same curiosity. There is scarcely anything in my experience about which I could not give a more satisfactory answer. A new world had opened upon me. If life is more than breath and the quick round of blood, I lived more in one day than a year of my slave life. It was a time of joyous excitement which words can but tamely describe. Anguish and grief, like darkness and rain, may be depicted. But gladness and joy, like the rainbow, defy the skill of pen or pencil." That gladness and joy must not have lasted very long, though. There were still 4 million Black people enslaved in the South. Douglas spent his whole life writing and speaking and advocating first to abolish slavery, and then to enforce political and social equality for Black people. And finally, when Reconstruction had failed and Jim Crow laws had restored white supremacy, Douglas kept touring the country and kept speaking as both a supporter of the Republican Party and also as a critic of it. What sustained him throughout this whole long career, all the way up until the 1890s? Douglas found religion when he was 13 or 14 years old in Baltimore. He met a Black preacher named Charles Lawson. Lawson was nearly illiterate, but he understood the Bible and he understood God. Douglas read the Bible to Lawson. He said later that I could teach him the letter, but he could teach me the spirit. Douglas began preaching while he was still enslaved in Baltimore at an African Methodist Episcopal church there. And after he escaped to freedom, he became a preacher with the AME church. He spoke at churches and used biblical analogies and quotations his whole life. He particularly liked the prophets Jeremiah and Isaiah. These are prophets who warned the Israelites that their disobedience of God, that they would be punished for it. And you can see why Douglas found them to be useful for quotes. When Douglas was 30, 10 years after his escape, he wrote a letter to his old master, Thomas Auld. He said, "The very first mental effort that I now remember on my part was an attempt to solve the mystery, why am I a slave? I had got some idea of God, the creator of all mankind, the Black and the white, and that he had made the Blacks to serve the whites as slaves. How he could do this and be good, I could not tell. I was not satisfied with this theory, which made God responsible for slavery. One night while sitting in the kitchen, I heard some of the old slaves talking of their parents having been stolen from Africa by white men and were sold here as slaves. The whole mystery was solved at once. From that time, I resolved that I would someday run away." Douglas wrote to his old master justifying his escape. He said, "The morality of the act I dispose of as follows. I am myself, you are yourself. We are two distinct persons, equal persons. What you are, I am. You are a man, and so am I. In leaving you, I took nothing but what belonged to me." And then, this passage is amazing in its compassion. He wrote, the responsibility which you have assumed is truly awful, and how you could stagger under it these many years is marvelous. Your mind must have been darkened, your heart hardened, your conscience seared and petrified, or you would have long since thrown off the accursed load and sought relief at the hands of a sin-forgiving God. I intend to make use of you as a weapon with which to assail the system of slavery, as a means of concentrating public attention on the system and deepening the horror of trafficking in the souls and bodies of men. I entertain no malice toward you personally. There is no roof under which you would be more safe than mine, and there is nothing in my house which you might need for your comfort, which I would not readily grant. Indeed, I should esteem it a privilege to set you an example as to how mankind ought to treat each other. I am your fellow man, but not your slave. Frederick Douglass. Right here is the whole answer for today. Douglass is both compassionate and angry. He is both forgiving and uncompromising. He picks his weapon and he rushes into the battle for justice. Ever since 2016, I've been wondering what American Buddhists can do about America's crisis. What is our role here, particularly? And when I look at the old sutras or the koans, right now they're not much help to me. The Buddha didn't have any project to reform ancient Indian society. Within the Sangha itself, he abolished caste, and women were somewhat more equal than they were in the larger society. But there's no record of the Sangha participating in local politics. Internally, they had a great political system. They followed an omniscient guru. Whenever they had a policy question, they asked him what the answer was, and he told them in excruciating detail and in verse. And our Chinese ancestors, 1,300 years ago, they lived in a time of great political turmoil and civil war, but we don't read about them voting or running for office or marching in protests. Political participation is a somewhat modern idea. Reforming society is a modern idea. Some people have found inspiration for work today from the ancient texts, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and the whole engaged Buddhist movement has lots of people who find guidance from the old texts for political activism. But right now, where I'm finding inspiration is American religion in the abolitionist era. This is our lineage too, just as much as the Asian monastics are. We descend just as much from these radical Protestants. We can look back at abolitionists like Benjamin Lay, a Quaker who lived in the 18th century. Shinryu Sensei gave an excellent talk about Benjamin Lay a couple of years ago, and I also recommend the biography called The Fearless Benjamin Lay. We can look to Frederick Douglass, who preached in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. We can look to the Congregationalist, Henry Ward Beecher, who raised money to buy slaves' freedom from a church in Brooklyn. We can look to William Lloyd Garrison, who founded the Liberator newspaper and the American Anti-Slavery Society. He was inspired by the writings of a Presbyterian minister. There's Oberlin College, where I went. It was one of the first co-ed and integrated colleges. It graduated the first Black woman in the United States. It was founded by radical Protestants. The whole abolitionist movement in the United States was led by Quakers, by Unitarians, by Methodists. And of course, religious leaders and religious groups have been at the forefront of the civil rights movement of the 1960s and of the women's suffrage and peace movements. Imagine if these people had said that religion and politics don't mix. Not all American Buddhists think that we have a responsibility to engage in politics. I do, and my partner Kayshen and I, we've been raising money for Joe Biden and texting voters and writing postcards to voters. We have been doing everything we can. I asked a Buddhist friend if he'd help me raise money for Joe Biden, and my friend wrote back, "I personally do not find a political appeal in accord with Buddhist practice. I am aware that there are practitioners who hold the opposite, but I have found it's usually because they have put worldly goals above enlightenment in the name of compassion for others." And in a way, he's right. I do have worldly goals in the name of compassion. That's why I'm a member of the Village Zendo. Joshin and Enkyo founded this group in the midst of the AIDS crisis with other activists. And the Sangha from the beginning has been both a place for traditional Zen training and also a foundation for activism. In the time that I've been a member here, we've marched against war and climate change. We have marched for a $15 minimum wage. We held vigils outside the governor's mansion for clemency and for prison reform. And that's my kind of Buddhist Sangha. And that's why I joined this Sangha 17 years ago. Now, you might have some objections. You might think that because the Buddha preached the middle path, that we shouldn't pick sides. But that's not what he meant by the middle path. In the oldest sutras, the middle path means not falling into the extreme of asceticism on the one hand, or of self-indulgence on the other. And in Mahayana sutras, the middle path avoids the extreme of believing in an eternal soul on the one hand, or on the other, believing that there's nothing that really exists and this is all a delusion. In our school, the principle of not knowing is the middle path. On the one hand, we don't have any fundamentalist dogmas. We know that we don't know. But on the other hand, we do have opinions. And it's my opinion that if Trump wins another 4 years, it will cause unimaginable suffering and death. The Buddha preached the middle path, but he also preached the precepts. Don't lie, steal, or kill. And I live in a democracy. I am responsible for what my nation does. And it's my responsibility to stop this nation from lying and stealing and killing. And there is no escape from this responsibility. Reforming this country is practicing precepts. You might also make a distinction between campaigning for causes versus campaigning for candidates. And people take this distinction very seriously, but it's very recent. It comes from a 1954 tax reform bill. Lyndon Johnson was a senator at the time, and he added a provision to the tax reform bill to prohibit religious institutions from campaigning for or against candidates. This was at the height of McCarthyism, and Johnson was trying to suppress right-wing religious support for McCarthyism. This taboo on religious organizations campaigning for candidates, it's got nothing to do with the First Amendment. It's not about the separation of church and state. It's not fundamental to the American system. It's a tax rule from 1954. So to be clear, the Village Zendo does not endorse a candidate, and the board of directors did not encourage me to talk about politics. I'm speaking for myself, and I have taken the Bodhisattva vow to practice the precepts and to protect beings from suffering. It's clear to me that American Bodhisattvas have to use all of our thousands of arms to ensure that Trump does not get another 4 years. If politics is an expression of our religions, then we have to have sacred means, not just sacred goals. So we have opponents, but we never have enemies. And we may be passionate, but we're never violent. And like Frederick Douglass, when he wrote to his previous owner, Thomas Auld, we have to be immovable in our principles, but forgiving toward our fellow beings. Now, Frederick Douglass was not a pacifist. He said that the moment he became a man was when he beat up a slave driver. And in the 1850s, he advocated killing slave catchers and slave holders. When the Civil War broke out, Douglass was ecstatic. He said that white supremacy would not be defeated unless Southern society was completely destroyed. And as a forecaster, he turned out to be right. Southern society was not completely destroyed, and white supremacy did endure. But as a Buddhist, I do not admire this bloodthirsty aspect of his thinking. Long after, in 1877, after the war, after emancipation and Reconstruction and the end of Reconstruction, when Frederick Douglass was 59, he went home to Maryland to see Thomas Auld. He wrote later that this homecoming was strange enough in itself, but to see his former master was still more strange. By this time, Thomas Auld was sick and bedridden, and his hands shook. Douglass wrote that he sat by Auld's bedside, quote, holding his hand and in friendly conversation with him in a sort of final settlement of past differences, preparatory to his stepping into his grave, where all distinctions are at an end, and where the great and the small, the slave and the master, are reduced to the same level. One question that had been nagging Douglass for his whole life was his birthday and the exact year of his birth, and Thomas Auld said right away that Douglass had been born in 1818. There's another thing that Douglass wanted to know, which was whether Thomas Auld was his father or not. And Douglass didn't ask him, and no one knows why he didn't. Douglass wrote, "He was to me no longer a slaveholder, either in fact or in spirit. And I regarded him, as I did myself, a victim of the circumstances of birth, education, law, and custom. Our fates were determined for us, not by us. Even the constancy of hate breaks down before the brightness of infinite light. God willing, we'll have the opportunity to forgive after this struggle. Buddha's teachings and abolitionist preachers like Douglass can show us the way how. So let's follow their example."